If you really want to understand critical race theory, you have to go back in time.
Their mission was to reestablish white domination, and they did that by monitoring every book in every classroom in the South.
From the African American Policy Forum, I'm your host, Kimberly Crenshaw. This is the United States of Amnesia, a miniseries explaining what CRT really is and what our reaction to it says about America's future. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
The 1992 Los Angeles uprising, the Cambodian genocide, Japanese-American incarceration. What you know isn't always the full story. Our new podcast, Inheriting, about Asian American and Pacific Islander families where the past is personal.
Korean Americans, we call it sa-i-gu.
Did you ever realize when you were a child that you became an orphan?
Camp was such a hard time. How do you think you got through it?
Listen to Inheriting from LAS Studios and the NPR Network. Wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly, an unapologetically intersectional podcast. I'm Sadia Khan. Today I am speaking with Mila Atmus, the host of the Future Hindsight podcast, known for her profound insights into civic engagement and democratic participation. Mila has spent years amplifying the voices of changemakers and thought leaders who shape our society. But who is Mila beyond the microphone? Our interview today delves into lesser-known facets of her life and career. Did you know Mila was born in Indonesia and raised in Germany before moving to the U.S.? She, like me, started her podcast journey after the 2016 elections. Before podcasting, Mila had this diverse career, including her time at Wall Street and a significant role at Sesame Street, where she helped launch a version of the show in Indonesia. And I can't wait to hear more about different dimensions of her work, career, and personal life. So without further ado, let's get started. Welcome to Immigrantly, Mila. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
So you are not in New York right now.
I'm not, yes.
So where are you?
I am on an island called Nantucket off the coast of Massachusetts.
How's the weather?
It is very foggy and very humid. It isn't really hot. It isn't really cold. It just feels like you are standing in a steam bath a little bit.
It's similar here, I guess, in New York City. It reminds me of Lahore. Lahore is extremely humid and hot.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Pakistan. So it reminds me a bit of Lahore, but not as much, because in Lahore, the temperature can go as high as 120.
Wow.
I mean, New York is nowhere close to that.
Mm-hmm.
Mila, you were born in Indonesia and you grew up in Germany, right?
Well, I grew up in Germany for part of my life. And so I was born in Indonesia. My parents are very young. So my father went to university in Germany, which is one of the reasons I grew up there. And then actually we moved back to Indonesia when I was 11. And so I do have experience of living in Indonesia. I'm from Jakarta. My family's from Jakarta, although ethnically we're not Betawi, which is the local native community. I'm really ethnically Javanese from Central Java. And so Jakarta is also very hot and very humid, not as hot as Lahore. But when I go home, when I step off the plane, it's like the humidity is like a wall. It just hits you and you're like, wow, it's so hot and humid. But Jakarta is not quite as hot as Singapore. But it is, I would say it's like 90 degrees all year round with a lot of humidity.
Oh, so you don't get seasons?
No seasons. It's on the equator. Basically, we have sunrise between 5:30 and 6 a.m. And the sun sets around 6 p.m. every day, all year round.
Oh, wow. You know, what brought you to the U.S.?
So I came to the U.S. as an exchange student. I was picked by a family in a small rural community in Idaho, about 20 minutes from the Utah border. And I spent one academic year there, my 10th grade year, and it was such a positive experience. I decided to stay, and I ended up going to a boarding school in Connecticut after that, and then I ended up going to college.
That must have been a big transition, right? Coming to Connecticut after Idaho?
Oh, huge. I mean, I think the culture shock between Idaho and Connecticut is maybe more severe in a way than going from Jakarta to rural Idaho, because I had a little bit of a sense of what that would be like. I mean, not exactly, of course, but here's a perfect example of what it was like. When I first came to the U.S., I really didn't speak English the way that I do today. And I learned a lot of ways to speak American English in Idaho. And then when I went to Connecticut, I was asking a friend of mine, I said, hey, do you want some pop? Because that's what people say in Idaho. And so this girl, she was from Huntington, New York and Long Island. She said, we don't say pop here. We say soda. And I said, excuse me. I'm so sorry. I am so ignorant. I did not know that on the East Coast, we don't say pop. We say soda. And I thought that was very interesting.
Okay, so you did college in New York and then you decided to stay in New York.
Yes.
Why?
Well, for most of my life, I didn't think that I would stay. It just was going to be a temporary thing. So most of my friends who are Indonesian, they would come to the U.S. and study. And then if they're lucky, get a job for a year or two and then go back to Indonesia. And I thought always that I would do that. And so I got a job and I thought I would stay for a year or two in this job. And I ended up staying. And that was kind of, I don't want to say it was not on purpose, but that's not how I planned it. You know, it was a good job. I met somebody that I fell in love with who's now my husband. And it's the kind of thing like I just didn't think it was going to turn out this way.
What was your first job?
My first job out of college, I was an assistant on a trading desk. And I worked for a small boutique Asian brokerage firm called W.I. Carr, which no longer exists. It was bought by Crédit Agricole while I was still working at W.I. Carr. And it was really a wonderful experience. It's a small firm, so everybody was really friendly. And I don't know if you know much about trading desks.
I don't.
Yeah, they're very horizontal organizations.
Huh.
So the head of the desk sits with you. And so it's like an open plan and everybody sits basically very close to each other. And, you know, this was in the 90s, so it's a long time ago. I think it's very different today, but the phones are ringing. It's very communal. I would say it's a little bit almost like being in a brotherhood when you come in there every day. We had a lot of fun. We laughed a lot. As an assistant, I was always getting lunch for everybody. And I did a lot of menial jobs like photocopying, you know, answering telephones. It was a good time. You know, I think this may be true for a lot of people when you look back of your time in your 20s. It all was, you know, relatively easy, which is to say, you know, I didn't have a lot of responsibilities except for showing up on time, answering the telephones, taking orders, running to get lunch, and being in community with the other people on the desk. And everybody just, you know, was very different then. I think today, my understanding is that if you work on a trading desk, you will have studied finance. But when I was working on a trading desk, it was a different time. There were people who were philosophy majors, French majors, English literature majors, all sorts of people. And really what united us is that we were on a trading desk and we were trying to sell people to buy stocks or sell stocks. You know, always be closing, as they say, and get the order.
So there was more cognitive diversity.
Yes, 100%. So my boss was a philosophy major and he would love to talk about everything under the sun. But yeah, people were very different. Really, people came from all walks of life on a trading desk. It was kind of a really egalitarian setup in a way that I think if you haven't worked on a trading desk, might sound really surprising.
It does, because when I think of a trading desk, I think of this quintessential capitalist grind, right? All about, you know, making money and long hours. I don't think about this communal setting and, you know, having those strong connections and relationships. But Mila, from that, you went to public service. You pivoted. Why did you decide to do that?
So on September 11th, I was sitting on a desk. We always had CNBC on, of course. My desk mate, the person who sat to my right, was talking to somebody who was working inside the World Trade Center. And she said, oh, there's a big bang. I think a bomb went off. And I was living in New York in 1993. I was in college. And that's when there was a bombing inside the World Trade Center in the parking garage downstairs. And I said to my desk mate, I said, tell her she must leave right now. Tell her to leave right now. Don't stay. Just get out. And I think she left right away. And then on TV, suddenly we saw the footage of the planes flying into the World Trade Center. And obviously the market never opened that day, but it was the kind of thing. We saw this in real time. And I walked home that day. It was a very beautiful, sunny day. I walked home. I had really bad shoes on. I remember I got blisters. And I got home. I thought to myself, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this? You know, this is in a way devoid of meaning. You know, it's really just about making money. Although, of course, I had really wonderful community there. You know, like I said, I really enjoyed working on a trading desk and I still have very strong friendships from that time. But I really thought working on a trading desk just doesn't matter. You know, I need to be doing something else with my life. And my family in Indonesia is very committed to public service. So when I was growing up, they always said, what's most important in life is to serve your country. So, you know, my grandparents were living through colonization and the independence movement, and they were very idealistic about serving. And so that was kind of something that I always grew up with. And I thought to myself, I need to be in public service. I don't need to be working on a trading desk.
Have you seen the Real Madrid lineup?
Colin Bridgerton's back.
With the undead.
And it's all about the Iron Throne.
You have to watch it.
What's it on? Bridgerton? Netflix?
The match is on TNT Sports.
House of the Dragon? Only on Now.
Ugh, that's the one I don't have.
TV that flexes with what's trending? New EETV lets you add and remove subscriptions monthly. Search EETV today.
EETV requires EE Broadband. 24-month contracts. Content may vary. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Looking to start a side hustle or become your own boss? Do it with Shopify. Whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify has the industry-leading tools to help you create, control, and grow your own business. So get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.co.uk/special offer.
Talk to me about how you conceptualized your role in public service post 9/11, almost 23 years ago, versus how it shows up now.
So 23 years ago, I was still an Indonesian citizen. And so I thought very deeply about how I could serve because it had become clear to me that I would never return to Indonesia to live there. I had just gotten married in 2001, earlier in the year. And I thought, well, how am I going to do this? I don't really know. How can I serve? And who would I serve? Would I go back to Indonesia and serve in the Foreign Service, let's say? Or would I become a citizen? Those were like all open questions. And I didn't really know what the answer was. And I decided to go to graduate school. I went to SIPA, the School of International and Public Affairs, and I thought I would find some answers there.
Did you?
In part, yes. So I also had a baby while I was at school, so that was also complicated. That complicated things. I think the answer that I got is I definitely want to be in public service, that I definitely wanted to do something that was about serving the public, even if that could be in a place that's not for the government. So actually, my first job out of SIPA was to work for Sesame Workshop. At the time, Sesame Workshop had just gotten a grant from USAID to start a local show, a Sesame Street in Indonesia. And they were looking for somebody who spoke fluent Indonesian, has a graduate degree, has experience writing curriculum, which I don't have, but I had something like 5 out of 7 things. You know, I was willing to work part-time and I was like, it's perfect. I have a baby, I can work part-time at Sesame. This is great. I interviewed for the job and I got the job. And that was really wonderful. And I learned a lot about how to get a TV show off the ground. You know, I was really a junior member of that team because there are people who have done a lot of work doing international shows like in Latin America and in France. And it was also a really wonderful community, very, very different than a trading desk, very deliberate, you know, lots of meetings. Like there are no trading desk meetings. At Sesame Workshop, we had a lot of meetings. I was like, wow, there's another meeting. Why? But I learned a lot And we did a trip to Indonesia with the producer and then the person who ran the education department. So I was a researcher in the education department, and I helped my boss write a white paper about the needs of Indonesian children and what kind of hole they would fill in the market for Indonesian children's television. And it was really fascinating to go on this trip because we went to Jakarta and we walked through the slums, which I had never done before. And it was really eye-opening. One of the big takeaways for me is that so many people don't understand what nutritious meals are. And so obviously in the slums, they don't have a lot of money. And you could see little children basically having the equivalent of Cheetos as lunch. And I had never seen that firsthand. You know, it's very different to hear about it or to read about it, but to actually see it. And I thought, yeah, this is a problem. You know, this is a big problem. And Indonesia actually has this really extensive program for public health that is community-based, where you come in and young mothers get their babies vaccinated and weighed on a monthly basis. And they get actually education for how to feed their children nutritious meals. But I think in the slums, that's less accessible than in the villages, in the rural areas, because they don't have that kind of same community, because it's like a makeshift community, right? It's not recognized really by the municipality, so they don't have the same kind of resources. And I thought to myself, wow, this is really fascinating, you know, to see firsthand, and also really devastating, because obviously you cannot have a fully functioning brain if you're eating Cheetos for lunch and you're 3 years old.
So that's where your public service journey started.
Yes.
So fast forward to 2016. And this is very interesting for me because my audio production, podcasting, content, whatever you call it, journey started around the same time, at least the concept of it. You decide to launch a podcast.
Yes.
How did that come about?
So because I grew up in Germany, I go to Germany a lot. And after the 2016 election, obviously everybody was, not everybody, but in my community, people were very upset. I was very, very upset. And I thought, you know, the problem is that people don't have a real connection to civic action. And I feel like voting or even being interested in the way that politics works, that the government works, is so far removed from everyday life. And I thought, you know, what ails Americans is that we don't have enough engagement. We're just so removed from each other. You know, like living in New York City, often you don't even know your neighbor, right? In most places outside of New York City, that's inconceivable that you don't know your neighbor. But in New York, it's very common. And of course, this is a broad generalization, but I felt like, you know, we need to buy in into what brings us together as Americans. And so I thought, you know, I really want to write a book about civic engagement. And I had a friend who is a book agent. And so I told her this idea, and she said, this is a great idea. You should definitely write a book about civic engagement. And she said, by the way, if you publish it, it would take at least 2 years before it hits the bookshelves. And I thought, oh, we don't have 2 years of time. Like, I want to have this conversation with Americans now, you know, I don't want to wait 2 years. And so I thought, well, I don't know. So I said, well, okay, this is really good to know. Let me think about it over the summer. So this was, you know, after the inauguration, this was in early 2017. And so that summer we went to Germany, my children and I, and we went on a walking tour about the rise and fall of Nazism in Munich. And it was really fascinating because the guide was not German. She was British. And she was telling us about how we have this idea that Hitler was really a monster and that Nazis were really monsters too. And I don't know why she said this, but she said, as it turns out, they're all humans just like us. And that essentially the norms changed over time. And something that was inconceivable and unacceptable 5 years prior became normalized and accepted. And I thought, oh, this is so interesting. I had not thought about it like this, that this was sort of like a slippery slope kind of evolution of the German people, who gradually all became Nazis. I mean, all is an overstatement, of course, but, you know, everybody was compelled to be a Nazi in that time. So, like, you didn't really have a choice.
At least complicit in the process, right?
Right. They were like, well, we're going to just look the other way. We know something is happening, but we don't really know exactly what. And some people, of course, knew more than others. And so I thought to myself, oh, this is so fascinating. And I thought to myself, well, this is very similar to what's happening in the U.S. You know, our norms are changing rapidly. And something that was not acceptable a year ago is acceptable today. And so I thought, I really don't have any time to waste. So that was the summer of 2017. And then I did my first interview in November of 2017. And then we launched our first episode in January of 2018 on the anniversary of the inauguration. And yeah, I think that first episode took me like 2 months to edit. It was a very, very steep learning curve. Like, I just really didn't know what I was doing. But I remember it was a really great first episode, not in terms of the production, but in terms of the content. You know, the person that interviewed, Bernard Harcourt, who I've since had on a few more times, he said, there's this idea that there is this invisible hand, like the market, and that things will just get taken care of by themselves, you know, that the marketplace will determine what's valid, what's not. And he goes, as it turns out, if you are not in the public sphere, somebody else is going to go in there and take over or dominate it, certainly, if your voice is not a part of it. And that's why you need to be engaged in your civic life and take civic action. Because if you're not making sure that your voice is a part of this process, then it will not be a part of this process.
So, Mila, you talk about these big ideas on your podcast that are then synthesized into actionable items, right?
Right.
Walk me through that process. Give me an example of an idea that's then converted into actionable items through these conversations.
I think in this current climate of still very heated debates about what schools should teach, how schools should get funded, I think an easy example is actually attending a school board meeting. Because a lot of people are saying you need to run for school board. And I think that's really, that's a big lift for most people. You know, one of the other premises that I had when I started the podcast was that there must be something that people can do between voting and running for office. Because a lot of people after the 2016 election said, well, I already voted. And it, quote, didn't work. So do I need to run for office next? And I thought, no, there must be something. There must be so many things you could do. And that was true. There are so many things you could do. And so when it comes to school boards, there's this idea that Moms for Liberty are running roughshod over school boards or other outfits that are similar to Moms for Liberty, people who want to ban books or kick people off the board. And actually showing up and showing interest, that in and of itself is very powerful, because a lot of these things happen essentially out of sight. If people show up and give testimony and say what they want to happen on the school board, I really think when a lot of people are there, it makes a huge impact. And I think there's normally when you show up to these meetings or if you go to a town hall meeting, let's say if you're community board or whatever, there's a handful of people and it's always the same people asking the same questions. But imagine if you and two of your friends show up and mix it up. I think that is incredibly powerful and you demand different things. And, you know, you step up to the microphone and you talk about what's important to you.
I like that idea, Mila. But for some, showing up or feeling that sense of belonging through civic participation is fraught with a history of othering. Mm-hmm. Some people even feel threatened. If they were to show up, would they be attacked? How would they be treated? There is this power dynamic that exists in the U.S. All of us know that, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's racial, socioeconomic. So why should people partake in a process that may appear biased to them? And if they were to show up, to your example, at a school board meeting, how do they protect themselves?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know how you protect yourself. I would say bring a friend at the very least. And if you don't want to speak up, don't, you know. But being present is hugely important because this affects your community. And if you don't know what's happening, then I don't know how you can take civic action. For sure, you need to start by being well informed. And if you don't want to speak up, it's okay. But then if you show up to the board meeting, let's say around election time, you know who the candidates are, then you can vote. accordingly. And I think that's also important because also some of these elections, I have very sparse turnout. For example, the mayoral election in New York City, it's always on an off year. It's never on a presidential year, which I think is a really big problem. But there in New York City, notoriously, the turnout for mayoral elections is between 20 and 25%. It's tiny.
Hmm.
So you don't have to be protected to go to the voting booth, but at the very least, vote in your local election. You know, that is very important. And people don't connect the dots. They don't understand that the mayor holds so many of the cards when it comes to our everyday existence. You know, I love to do an anecdotal sampling of taxi drivers, and always around election time, I ask them if they have voted. And I would say 9 out of 10 cab drivers will not have voted in the mayoral election. And some of them, though, are very proud to report that they have voted in the presidential election. And it's like, yes, that's great. Please continue to do that. But please also vote for mayor, because especially as a taxi driver, this affects you so directly in ways that I think they just don't comprehend.
Have you had conversation with them about why they don't vote or why they've chosen not to?
Yes. So that's always my next question, if they didn't vote. And I would say all of them say that all politicians are corrupt and that it just doesn't matter if they vote or not. And I think that's really terrible. But for sure, New York has a corrupt mayor. So I can't blame them for thinking that. You know, so it's a kind of thing where I'm like, yes, yes, it's true. There is a lot of corruption. But, you know, if you don't vote, though, then it's not going to get better. So it's a little bit of, you know, the circular reasoning. And it's really hard to break through. It's really, really hard. And I think when it comes to New York City, personally, I'm a fan of moving mayoral elections to the presidential cycle, because presidential cycles, the turnout in New York City is something like 65%.
Hmm.
So they might as well vote at the same time, you know, for mayor.
What role do you believe technology plays in shaping the future of civic participation? Have you seen any big changes happening due to technology?
You know, I don't know exactly how it could do that, but I've been thinking about, I think what we need to do is have like a fun game or app that talks about civic action. And I also think that when it comes to technology, we definitely should have automatic voter registration across the country, because technology can do that.
Mm.
If they can send us our tax bill and tell us that we didn't pay our taxes correctly, they can definitely automatically register us. It's not a secret who we are. You know, there are records of us from the day that we are born in
right.
this country. If you have a birth certificate, we know when you turn 18, you know? So it's the kind of thing like, okay, maybe you moved or whatever. But like if you were in school, every high schooler, if you don't want to do automatic voter registration, I think you should have a huge voter drive when you turn 18. You know, there are so many ways that you could do this. But automatic voter registration, that's the perfect example of technology getting us there, because that is one of the biggest hurdles to voting, is that people are not registered.
You really think that is the hurdle? Because sometimes I feel it's also disillusionment with the choices that they have and the process itself, because the democratic process in the U.S. is not as democratic as we would like to think, right? You think about super PACs and you think about lobbying and gerrymandering, and then you're like, it's not fair. It's not as democratic. So why should I just go and vote? Because nothing is going to change.
Yes, I hear that loud and clear. It's true, of course. Everything you're saying is true. Registration is not the only problem. I would actually think that the number one problem is voter apathy, to your point, that they're like, whatever. But I think voter apathy is not only because it feels like it's unfair and because politicians are corrupt or playing dirty with the process when it comes to gerrymandering or redistricting, but I think people's lives are really full and they can't pay attention to everything that's happening. I would say most people in the United States don't know what Project 2025 is.
Can you talk a little bit about what Project 2025 is?
So Project 2025 is a white Christian nationalism ideology that was written by the Heritage Foundation and is meant to be a blueprint for the first 180 days of any conservative president, whether that's Trump or not. And it includes things like, and this is very important to me as a family of people who have served in public service, that basically they would fire all public service employees unless they are partisans, and only hire partisans. And that is so that they can implement their agenda of, for example, making this a white Christian nation. And I think that's terrifying for somebody who is neither white nor Christian.
Why do you think people don't know about this as much? Why aren't we seeing it in the media? Why aren't we hearing about it from politicians?
So I don't think that politicians who support this want people to know about it because it's so extreme and very radical. And the media, this is my personal opinion about the media, to be clear. So, I mean, I don't think that this is how the media would describe themselves. But, you know, so the media is not interested in talking about it because it doesn't sell like bashing Biden for his performance. And I think there's also this idea that even if Trump is elected or any other conservative, I mean, I wouldn't call Trump conservative, but I think there is disbelief that this agenda will be implemented.
Even now?
Yeah, even now.
I mean, after Supreme Court's immunity decision, that's surprising to me. That should be a huge red flag, right?
It should be. But I really think that people are like, oh, it's not going to happen here. But it is happening here.
It is
it's already happening here.
Yes.
But I think people still don't really, they don't really take it in like that. I don't know what to tell you because, you know, I have friends who voted for Trump. And they just think it's going to be okay. They just think it's like, oh, it's just exaggeration. It's not going to happen. And you're like, I don't know why you think that, you know?
You're right. Look, listeners, do research on Project 2025. Educate yourselves. It's so, so, so important, right? Knowing what may happen, what is happening. Democracy is messy and systems and structures are fluid. They are not as strong as we think they are. But anyways, moving on. Mila, when you interview people on your podcast or when you have these conversations, given the polarized political climate, how do you maintain journalistic integrity, whatever form it comes in? Like how do you make sure that, you know, you're working within those certain parameters?
Well, my number one lens is that I'm pro-democracy. And I don't really invite people on who are not pro-democracy.
I like that.
And I just kind of feel like I'm not going to hide it, right? Like if somebody is going to spout about the big lie, then they're not pro-democracy. What can I say?
If you could interview any historical figure about their views on modern democracy, who would it be?
I think I would probably interview Malcolm X.
Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask who yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you.
I had read his autobiography a long time ago in college, and honestly, it's one of those things where as I'm rereading things, it's shocking how little I remember. So I reread it by audio book form this time with my younger son in the car 2 summers ago. And he said to me afterwards, wow, he predicted everything that was going to happen at the end of the book.
Yes.
And he also said, every American high schooler should read this book. And I thought, yes, in fact, you're right. Every American high schooler should read this book. And I just think he was so clear. It was really fascinating just how sharp his intellect was.
Yes.
And also, it gives you this real affirmation that going to college doesn't make you smarter.
Right.
I don't think that anybody ever really says that. But this idea that like if you don't go to college, you know, your life is going to be lesser than other lives. And for sure, this is not true.
We've seen college educated, ignorant people.
Yes.
So
Yes.
Yeah, there you have it. What would you ask him, though?
I would ask him two things.
Hmm.
The first is, how do we get out of this mess? What would he say about that? And the second is, would you have predicted this outcome where we are today, you know, in the year 2024? I would guess that maybe he would have maybe not exactly predicted where we are today, you know, exactly who the players are and all this. But I think he would have predicted this kind of dysfunction. But, you know, if he had been alive throughout all this time, he would probably have really, really good insight. Last summer, we also, my son and I, listened to the Slate podcast about Clarence Thomas.
Hmm.
And Malcolm X is also an idol of Clarence Thomas's.
Oh, wow.
And so
I did not expect that.
Okay. You need to listen to the Slow Burn episodes about Clarence Thomas. I think it's only 8 episodes. It's pretty short. Anyway, after we listened to both, my son said, I wonder whether Malcolm X would be conservative today, like Clarence Thomas. And I thought, that's an interesting question. I don't really know. And then my son said, well, one thing is for sure, though. He may be conservative, but he would never be corrupt.
Yes. Although I can't even imagine him being conservative the way we define conservatism today.
Yes.
When I think of Malcolm X, when I see his speeches, I think he would be this ultra-progressive, left-leaning. Again, how we define those terms today. I'm going to pivot a little, Mila. So you've talked about gratitude rituals, right? What are some of the things that you follow these days?
Oh, I keep it very simple. It has to be really something that affects me in my daily life.
Hmm.
Because I think it's really tangible. So it's a good meal, it's a nice walk, it's spending quality time with my children. So I do this with my kids at night, and we talk about what we're grateful for in the day. And it could be anything. It could be having a good laugh with a friend. It's really simple because I think, especially when you're talking about big ideas, it's really, really easy to lose track about what really matters. And I think what really matters is having a healthy life, having a good community, having loving relationships. Those kinds of things are really important.
When you think about the legacy you want to leave behind through your work, what is the one impact or change you really hope to see as a result of all the work that you're doing right now?
Well, this is like a really big dream, and I don't know if this will be achievable, but I'm really hoping that when we get through all of this in the end, that people will take civic action into consideration into their daily decision trees. When they read the newspaper, when they go to the grocery store, when they talk to a teacher, when they communicate with their children. I think it just needs to be infused in your daily lives in a way that you're thinking about your vitamins. And I'm hoping that we can do that as a people.
In the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's a place that has a very large spectrum of divergent voices and interests. And in this moment, the year 2024, we're trying to figure out how we can live together and find a way to pursue, I think, this common dream of being American.
Thank you so much, Mila. This was wonderful. Thank you for coming on Immigrantly.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
So, full disclosure, I did not know about Project 2025 until a few days ago. And when I learned about it, I was completely freaked out. So as I said during the interview, it's so important to educate ourselves. And look, democracy is messy. Systems and structures can change. What's important is how we partake in this process. And believe you me, I know, I hear all of you when you see what's out there, what the choices are, and those choices are not perfect. I've been of the same mindset. I don't see both choices as viable options. But you know what? There are ways to make sure that our voices are heard, to make sure that our future generations are safe. This episode was produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Hazik Ahmed Farid. Our theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. A huge shout out to CDM Studios, where we've been recording episodes for the last 5 years. Come back next week when we have another incredible conversation for all of you. Take care, be safe, and be informed.